Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This is the fifth and final full day of activities in St. Louis for the 10th IBM-SAM Combined Convention. This was the day when dealers made their last pitches to sell, the contest winners were announced, and people said their farewells. As far as the podcast goes, Saturday started off early with the annual Order of Merlin breakfast, which is for those IBM members with 25 or more years of consecutive membership. The guest speaker was Lupe Nielsen, who spoke about the Nielsen Magic Poster Collection. Lupe allowed me to record and broadcast her speech, which you can hear here. Afterwards, I had a brief chat with the incoming national president of the SAM, Kenrick Ice McDonald, who gives us his vision and plan for the organization and his travel plans for the coming year. During lunch, I sat down with Dr. Larry Haas and Eugene Berger, who talk about the importance of scripting, as well as having a director to help you improve your performance. We cap off this podcast with a chat with Magic Magazine editor Stan Allen, who tells us about next year's Magic Live, as well as the Magic Summit coming up this fall, which is designed to help all magicians develop better relationships. He also tells us about M360, the iPad versus the PDF version of the magazine, and more. The IBM and the SAM, as well as the FISM judges, awarded the prizes in stage and close-up, plus the names of those who will represent North America at the FISM Championships next year in Rimini, Italy. For a complete list, be sure to visit themagicwordpodcast.com. But for now, enjoy the last day of the combined convention here on The Magic Word.
She has been in the magic world for over 40 years. May I present Ms. Lupe Nielsen, speaking on behalf of Norm about their magic poster.
Are you recording?
All right. Well, hi there.
Hi.
Let's see, I think I'm the youngest person in this group. It's so funny, but to my credit, but before I start, I want to thank Sonny Johnson for organizing the breakfast. Thank you so much, Sonny. It's a wonderful occasion. And I want to thank you all for getting up so early this morning and coming here, and thank you to Sean Farquhar and all the guys at the IBM. You guys really put on a class act. Everybody dresses up in the morning here, so it is great. You look so great. Hold on, I have to take my Facebook picture. Hold on. This is awesome. Smile. This is Facebook material, I tell you. This is anyway, I'm truly, truly grateful. And what really makes this special is I joined my first magic organization was in around 1980. I joined the first magic organization, and it was the other guys. 1980. I was telling people this is like red states and blue states, you know. So I joined the other guys in 1980, and 4 years later, somebody sponsored me for the IBM. So I've been a member of the IBM since 1984. So it's really cool to be in the same world. And I have known Norm Nielsen since 1989, and we've met, you know, on and off, and I've been hanging out with Norm 24/7 for 20 years. And we hang out, and there is this love of posters and the love of collecting and his love for performing always rubs off on you. So Norm's passion, as you know, were the posters, and he literally owns the world's or that North America's largest collection of poster lithographs. Now, these lithographs, and I think I speak better when I'm unplugged from the table. But this collection of lithographs is huge. It's amazing, and it encompasses posters from the golden age of magic and the golden age of stone lithography. Now, the these posters are from about 1890 to 1930, and I know June Horowitz must have known almost every guy in those lithographs. It's amazing. Now, is anybody here a collector, a magic collector? Raise your hands of apparatus, books. Yeah, there's a bunch of collectors. Okay. Now, the lithographs, are very rare. Now, people say, why are these collectibles? Well, these are collectibles because the method of printing for these forms of advertisement is no longer used. These lithographs were printed using limestone. And it is a process, it's nearly chemical. You have to put some crayon, some waxy crayon, and then add the inks to the stones. And this will attract or repel the inks on specific areas of the stone. Each stone represents a color, and they are registered. So you would have a poster, if it's a four-color poster, you have a stone that was yellow, another stone that was red, another stone that was blue, and so on. And this paper goes through the stones, and it creates this splash of color. Now, the man that popularized stone lithography was a Frenchman called Jules Charest in France. And before that, like in the 1880s, all advertisements were black and white, things that you had to read very detailed, what the shows were about. And then all of a sudden, this guy decided to put color in the posters. And it was this color explosion, this splash of color, where if a performer went to a specific town, they would paper the whole town with these enormous lithos and posters all over the place in order to advertise the spectacle. Now, remember, at that time there was no television, no radio, so these posters entice you to go and see the show. Now, they're collectibles, but at that time, they were worth nothing. They were printed on very cheap, highly acidic paper. And why are these collectibles to magicians? Well, for instance, Harry Houdini, who was a master promoter, used every single piece of paper that he had. He didn't want to leave any piece of paper in the drawer. And Harry Houdini posters are very difficult to obtain. You can probably find two or three of each lithograph in the entire world. And that's why they are so expensive, and that's why they are so collectible. Now, Carter, for instance, I believe he died in his seventh or eighth world tour. And after he passed away, all of a sudden, there was a whole warehouse of his posters found in San Francisco. So, because there are so many of them, but by not less beautiful, they're more common. Therefore, nowadays you can find a Carter lithograph for a reasonable amount of money, probably $400, $500. You can get a pretty nice lithograph from 1926. So, instead of me doing all the blah, 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 I will show you the slideshow here. So this is the Nielsen poster collection. Can the people in the back see? Yeah, okay. That is great, because this room is so beautiful. It has so many windows that we were concerned about that. So it all started 24 years ago, around 1990, and Norm was performing at a theater in Madrid, Spain, at La Scala in Madrid. And he met this magician called Victor King from Argentina. Now, Victor was very fond of Norm, and as a parting gift, he gave him a poster of Fu Manchu. But the poster he gave him was like two posters that were incomplete. So you had to take pieces of one poster and put it together with pieces of another poster, and they made up that particular image. And that was Norm's first, very first magic poster. Later, about 6 months later, Norm went to a magic convention, and there we go, the dealer's room, the infamous dealer's room. There was Mario Carandi with his entire booth of posters and collectibles. And Norm saw this poster. It was a poster of Fraxon. And he said, wow, I met Fraxon. He was in Madrid. And he said, I would love that poster. Now, this poster is very rare. I only know of two. One is in our collection, the Nielsen collection, and somebody told me that there is a collector in Spain that has another one, and I saw a picture of it in a photo somebody showed me. And of course, dealers have to wheel and deal, so Norm said, hey, you have another poster in your booth, and it was a Carter, beautiful Carter Priestess of Delphi, so he got a good deal for the two posters. So there was a third poster. And since then, we have lost count. We literally lost count. We lost count until like 12 days ago when I officially finished cataloging the entire collection. So anyway, now how do you get posters? If you become a collector, how do you get stuff? So in the 1990s, Norm was really, really active in trying to find posters. Every day he would get up and he would say, what poster am I going to get today? Seriously. Every time he got up, he drove me nuts. It was awful. He would put ads in newspapers and publications like the LA Times, you know, and other newspapers. He purchased them one by one. If he saw a poster he liked, he would buy it. He would purchase entire collections. Somebody passed away and the widow had a collection of posters, and there could have been only one poster in that collection out of like 25, and he would buy the whole thing just to get the one poster. He attended auctions and that traded with other collectors. For instance, this one, a Leon Herman, exquisite poster. He put an ad in the LA Times and a lady called him and he said, Norm, I have a poster for you. This is of the great Herman. So he went to see the lady, and he thought he was ready. I mean, he had money in his pockets. And the lady said, you know, I really have to get $500 for this poster. And Norm said, oh, all right. Okay, here's your $500. But that is an exquisite and very rare Leon Herman poster. This other fellow, he used to work with Hardeen in his show. And out of an ad in the newspaper, he called Norm, and Norm got his first Houdini poster, which was The Buried Alive. Now, a trivia with this Buried Alive poster, that is the most common Harry Houdini poster. And the reason? He never used it. He was planning to do the Buried Alive stunt in 1926, and that was the year that he passed away. So this is, if you want a cheap Houdini poster, that's the one. That they normally run this one in a market value anywhere between $8,000 to $10,000 for that particular poster, and that's cheap for a Houdini poster. And Jay Marshall was the guy that made Norm who he is. Norm says without Jay Marshall, he would not have had a magic career. Jay basically was almost like Norm's dad, and Jay was instrumental in hiring Norm for a convention where Norm met Okito, and Norm learned how to make props from Okito, and also Jay arranged an audition for Norm to be with Mark Letty, and that led Norm to be at the Ed Sullivan Show, which allowed him to get his contracts in Europe and become a professional magician for so long. So Norm owes his life, literally, to this man. Now, Jay Marshall got all his posters from Ed Miller. And Norm would go to Chicago and wheel and deal with Jay at the time. And he managed to get a few good posters from Jay, like this one, The Eclipsing Sensation. That poster is so rare. There's only two copies in the world. One is Norm's collection, and the second one was Christian Feschner's. And that was auctioned off a few years ago and went to a gentleman in India. So we don't know where this poster, the other poster is. But that's the classic poster of Houdini. Another one, this one is a unique poster, is of Chong Ling Su and the ribbons, a three-sheet size poster. And we have the Houdini for president, one of the most popular images, made into a postage stamp a few years ago. And this one is Norm's Pride and Joy. It's an eight-sheet poster of Harry Houdini, very unique piece, where he is launched into an escape from a cruise ship or a vessel there. So it was about all these posters that I showed before were acquired before 1993. Now in 1993, Jay Marshall calls Norm and he says, "Come on over to Chicago. I want you to help me with the posters." And Norm came running to Chicago, and Norm was there with Marshall Brodin, who was helping him out. And Jay said, "Okay, grab all the posters you want and put them on a pile." And Norm cataloged the things. He couldn't believe it. He had to stay there overnight. He slept over there at the upstairs in Magic Inc., you know. So Norm put it in a pile. And Jay said, "You know, I have decided to sell you my collection." So Norm was really excited about that. And I won't get into the details because that's for another lecture. David Copperfield called a few days later. And Norm, unfortunately, had to split the collection with David Copperfield. So, and that's when that purchase happened. But Norm was pretty happy. I mean, the seed of Norm's collection is a Jay Marshall collection. And there we go. So I'll play a little segment here so that you can see some of the posters from the Jay Marshall collection.
If I had my way, dear, forever there'd be a garden of roses for you and for me.
Jay Marshall. The next big collection that Norm acquired was in 1997. It was a New Zealand Charles Cabot collection. And this was a collection of about over 100 posters and included lithographs, very rare, from like Jansen, Sue, Powell, Maskelyne, and Cooks. And it was an amazing collection. This collection came on through the internet. Some private seller was saying, "Are you interested in magic posters?" And Norm says, yeah, okay. And they sent us the pictures. And it wasn't easy to get it because we had to compete and do an online auction with probably about three or four other parties. And the collection came from Wellington, New Zealand. Norm couldn't travel to Wellington at the time, so I went to New Zealand. I think I went on a Wednesday, arrived there Thursday, did the deal, and then I came back like Saturday or Sunday. So I could only take a few shots of the city because I was too pooped at that trip. Now, Charles Cabot was an advanced man for many of the acts in New Zealand that came through, and he got all the posters from them, and he was also the doorman at the State Opera House in Wellington. And these are the posters. When I brought them back, they're on our dining table there. That's what they look like when I brought them back. And Norm had a big smile on his face looking at that rare Janssen poster. And this one is a Powell poster. See, that's before the restoration, and that's after the restoration. And the posters were pretty easy to remove from their backings, which we were very pleased about that. And there's some other posters from the New Zealand collection. Those Carters are very rare. They're from 1904. And a Carter used all that paper from that era. So we were super delighted with that. And some are very rare, the Beer posters. And that Sioux, we saw that Chongling Sioux in John Davenport's collection, and we wanted that Sioux forever, and we got it in the Cowan collection. That was really a treat. And Mike Caveney had the other Janssen portrait. So now there's two. Woohoo! Okay. auctions, Butterfield and Butterfield auction. This was a great deal. I think that auction was like in 1998 or 99. And we got that Houdini poster for, I think, $9,000. And you wonder, why didn't it go for more? Well, that poster was covered with a piece of plastic. It wasn't plasticated. Nobody even wanted to touch it. And Norm was always crazy about his posters. And he says, we have to remove this from the plastic from this poster. So we sent it to a place in Chicago, and after 3 months they returned it, they couldn't do it. So what we did is we got a big tub in the workshop, and we dipped it in some sort of solvent and removed the plastic off. And it was pristine, almost pristine. The only thing that was slightly faded was the background, which was slightly restored, but everything else in the poster came out very smoothly. So Norm was really happy. The next one was this Houdini. It was at a Christie's auction, and it came out a year later. And that was it broke the world record at the time. I put there some not decided to pay the most for a magic poster, which was £36,168.75 British pounds. That was close to $50,000 for that poster. And because I'm short of time, but there's a story on how we came up with the money for that one. So. But he was nuts. I mean, it was like, oh my gosh, I want that poster. So there's three of these in the world. David Copperfield has two, and the other one is in our collection. Now, the other big one, who was from here? Who went to the Egyptian wholesale? The Egyptian wholesale was amazing. David Price had the biggest poster collection in the world at the time. And it was in Tennessee, and George Daly and Mike Caveney purchased the thing. And they purchased it with money. I don't know where they got the money. But they had to do a sale of all the stuff, of at least a third, a substantial amount of the collection in order to pay for their houses, to get their houses back. But there was a huge warehouse, and they put all the surplus of all these posters all along the walls of the warehouse. I mean, look at this thing. And all the collectors congregated, and it was an amazing auction. This was like the event of the year. Posters and posters and posters of, you know, David Price's stuff. And there's the auction, and Mike Caveney is right there. And you see the poster on the podium. We wanted that, so we got it. There it is, the Keller Casadega propaganda. And the posters were in one of the posters we got. It was in Thurston. It was on a board. And again, we do crazy things with posters, so we put it in the bathtub so that we could bring it to Vegas because it wouldn't fit in the luggage. And it came out beautifully. Look at it. It's already framed and up, you know. And that was pretty cool. And these are some of the posters from that particular sale. A beautiful Okita poster. And at Sid Radner auction, October of 2004, we got two major posters for the collection. These were the Houdinis, the Houdini in Russia and the other Houdini in the courtroom scene. Now, many people ask, well, how many posters does Norm have? Well, I think it's about 2,100 plus posters. It's over 2,000 posters, and our small museum houses about 500 of those posters, and the rest are in drawers, as my friend Simone has seen. So I'm going to do a very quick slideshow and of favorite posters from our collection and give you a little taste, you know, of what we have. So Howard Thurston's. And there we go. It is neat. The posters on Thurston, where you notice the two portraits, they're dated from 1908, when the mantle was passed by Keller to Thurston. So again, the two portraits. That means it's a 1908 portrait, poster. And, of course, Norm loves Okito posters for obvious reasons. Okito was a mentor of his that taught him how to build magic and allowed Norm to do most of the tricks that he manufactured. So that's a classic Okito portrait. And, of course, Okito was famous for his floating ball. This one was under Maureen Christopher's bed. She didn't even know what she had, and Norm cried out of Maureen. And this one we found in Finland from Mr. Solmu Makela. And, of course, Harry Keller. A decent collection can be complete without Keller posters. And everybody had this poster. All the major collectors, we never had that poster. It took us like 8 years to get that poster. And when we got the poster, we looked at each other and we said, we finally have a poster collection. We said, Klosterman has it, and the other guy has it. But we don't have that poster. And of course, favorite magicians of Norm's are Carl Germain and Servais Leroy. And other favorite posters, Masculine and Cooks. I mean, I could go on and on and on. It's just staggering. Some are more common, some are very rare posters. And there are various reasons why somebody would add something to their collection. And you, if you do collecting, you have your reasons why you want a specific type of prop. And Norm collects these posters because these were his favorite magicians, like Cardini.
Good night, ladies. Good night, ladies.
Anything that has Cardini in it, Norm enjoys.
Good night, ladies. Good night, ladies. We're born to lead.
And the other fellow is Channing Pollock. Channing moved to Las Vegas, I think it was in 2002 or 2003, and he became very, very close to Norm. So in the last few years of his life, we enjoyed his company immensely. He was Norm's best friend. And the collection has 58 Channing Pollock posters. And of course, Norm's collection has probably the largest colored vintage lithograph collection of Harry Houdini in the world. He probably has, I think, over 20 colored lithographs of this performer. A lot of challenges and black and white pieces of Harry Houdini, but in color is extremely difficult to find those pieces. And of course the Chung Ling Soo collection. Believe it or not, in our living room, we used to have French posters all over the living room. Charades and mukas and things like that. And then the decor was oriental. And I told Norm, why don't you move the Chung Ling Soos to the living room? So one day, it took us about 3 days to move all the Soos to the living room and hang them appropriately. Had the most variety of lithographs that we know of. We probably know of about 85 images out there. The Soos that we have is 64 images in total, and they're all on display at our home. So I've given you a virtual tour of the collection, and many people ask, well, what's next? What's going to happen? Regardless of whatever happens, the thrill for a collector is in the hunt for the item. That's what I have noticed. They love to hunt for that little next item, and once they have that trophy, then they go for the next one. Norm just turned 80 a few months ago, and I don't know. I suppose he is now looking back and thinking. Probably his collection might go into auctions and be shared amongst collectors. We think it's a better choice than giving them to an institution, simply because collectors tend to love their items so much and preserve them in the proper manner. So, but still, you know, we know that there's always room for the next one. So I thank you so much for your attention, and hope you enjoy the presentation.
Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com. And we just finished a wonderful breakfast, Merlin breakfast over here, with a presentation by Lupe Nielsen talking about the poster collection, which you guys have just heard. And so now I'm here with Ice McDonald. Hi there, Ice.
Hello. How are you doing?
Incoming president for the national president for the SAM. So you got quite a year ahead of you.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of things in store for this year.
Anything that you can kind of share with us? And I mean, what is your mission? What is your vision for this year?
Well, my vision is, as I've been saying, is the year of the member.
Yes.
We appreciate our members, but they're not told as often as they should be. So being the year of the members, we're going to highlight a lot of our society's members.
Are you going to be going around to a lot of the clubs making visits this year?
We are. Yeah, okay. That's our goal, is to reach out and touch all the assemblies and just let them know that we're not taking them for granted.
They appreciate.
Very important. Yeah. Yes.
And try to build up membership.
Absolutely.
Because they're the core, the backbone, really.
Absolutely.
Of the organization.
Another thing that we're trying to do is make the society younger.
Okay.
You know, when I was in the society as a young man, I was in that position. Now that I'm getting a little more mature in age, we need some of the young artists to try to embrace what we're doing.
And so how are you going to do that? I mean, what kind of benefits? Are there additional or new things that are going to be offered?
Well, they have mentoring programs and everything, but we're bringing in a lot of the young SYM members who have transitioned over into SAM.
Right.
And they are starting to shadow and do a few things in the program of the SAM. And a lot of times what will happen is people will join things if they see someone that looks like them. You know, if the young folks start seeing young members, they're going to go, wow, that organization is forward-thinking because they have young people there, and maybe that's something I want to participate in.
Right. Right, that makes sense. Because I think, again, the future of our organizations,
right,
both the IBM and the SAM, are going to lie in the hands of the youth, and we really need to encourage that. And I understand it's another thing that you'll be doing and working with Sean Farquhar this year with the IBM, really trying to encourage people to join the organizations.
Right, yes. One of the things that we wanted to do, and I am here at the Order of Merlin, so, you know, I've been a member of IBM for 25 years.
Yeah.
So it's not.
You're getting your Merlin today.
So my our objective is magic. Infusing magic with young artists that's going to take the art to another level.
Yes.
Not just the Society of American Magicians, or not just the International Brothers of Magicians, but magic, making magic younger, so our art form can continue.
Yes, because it is a fraternal organization.
Absolutely.
And it's a big fraternity that encompasses all ages.
Absolutely.
And all backgrounds, cultures, ethnicities, whatever. And so we're just one big happy family.
Absolutely.
Literally.
Yeah,
yes. Yeah. And so I appreciate what you're going to be doing and sharing the word and spreading magic around the country. Now, we have ambassadors to other countries. Do you plan on making some international travel this year?
I'll most likely be going over to London. I'm trying to go into Spain. Canada hasn't invited me, so
yeah,
I'm going to try to do that. Bermuda just asked me to come down to see their assembly.
Now, when we were at Fechner's earlier this year, I think I may have asked you this, because the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, and so let me ask again, what is your magic word? What's important to you this year?
Important to me is unity.
Man, that says it all. You give me goosebumps, because that's what you've been preaching, man, you know, to everybody, and saying we have to be together as one group, and so that's what we need is unity.
Absolutely.
That's perfect for what, you know, you and Sean and everybody are doing. Well, congratulations, and good luck on your coming year.
Thank you so much.
That was Ice McDonald for the Magic Word Podcast. Scotty out. So, Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and it is lunchtime, and we just... I probably should have turned on the microphone as we were enjoying lunch, because we had a nice little conversation with Dr. Larry Haas. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And Mr. Eugene Berger.
Oh, Gene. Scott. It's always fun to talk to you.
It always is. And to all of the listeners who are out there in listener land then as well. I started to say, Dr. Eugene, and now where did you... Was it Loyola? Were you teaching in Loyola? Or were you schooled? Where did you go to college and then you taught?
I went to Beloit College in Wisconsin, and I went to a year at Luther Theological Seminary in St. Paul, and then I went to Yale Divinity School, where I got a degree, and then I went to University of Illinois, where I got another degree, and then eventually I left.
Okay.
became director of welfare in Evanston.
You had too high of degrees, I guess, so you kind of got a temperature, and so you got sick. You got sick
exactly,
of it.
Exactly. Well, you know, my first year of teaching, I knew the names of like 90% of my students. In my
really?
Last year, I knew three of them.
And that's when you decided this is not for me.
It felt that maybe it was time to move on.
Now, when you were studying theology, was there a particular branch of religion that had gotten you into divinity? Or?
Yes, I think it was really the writings of Paul Tillich, one of the great theologians of the 20th century, who understood that at the heart of religion there's a great deal of metaphor, symbol, and myth.
Mm-hmm.
And that this isn't bad,
right.
It's just the way it is.
Right, yes. Yeah, when you study the historical Jesus, you know, that's and the mythical one, you know, there's some things that just don't line up, you know.
And I felt that it would be interesting to approach magic kind of in the same way, to look at magic not just as tricks or as a show, but also to look at magic as a repository of myths and symbols and metaphors.
Hmm.
And what are, I mean, example, the cut and restored rope is a metaphor of healing.
Okay. Well, yeah, so many restorations, I guess, you know,
exactly.
One of the basic elements, as Carol Petsky pointed out over there. Do you talk about those kinds of things in the class?
Yeah, well, I think we do. We spend more time talking about people's acts and masters.
And not so much the depth of the
right.
Why they're doing it.
We save a lot of the deeper stuff for our Magic and Meaning conference in Las Vegas in October, which is a lot of people getting together who just want to explore magic at a deeper level.
And is that just a lot more theoretical as opposed to
it's both.
Methodical?
It's both, because we have shows and people, of course, are still trading tricks and
sure.
teaching each other things here and there. But no, the main idea is to look at magic in a slightly different way and to see what we find.
I always enjoy having my best discussions are when I'm talking with someone more about the depth of magic and not necessarily just about, you know, presentational stuff, but there's a lot more stuff. And what you're talking about, you know, the metaphors for life, you know, with the cut restored rope or something, you know, like that, I think are what makes people to understand magic at a completely different level. So whenever they're performing that they start coming up with other presentations, and it also comes more from the heart rather than just, okay, well, this is a script, I can plug and play this, or when I'm putting together a show, I can do this, this, and this because it is a different effect, as opposed to something that is going to be, you know, from your heart, well, this is going to be for this particular group, and I think that I should probably, you know, talk about this or that because I am conscientious that there is someone here who is suffering from cancer. You know, I recently did a show at a home party and someone that was a young boy with cancer. And so there are certain things that you want to do then that would, you know, not be too, you know, it would be kind of fun, of course, but not, you know, bring down the room. But you want to be sensitive and to, and I think that you need to be sensitive to your audiences all the time, assuming that there are people out there who are affected by what you say and do. And if you say or do something offensive, I'm not an advocate for an example of the baffling bra trick, you know, mm-hmm. that there are places, you know, in kids' parties, perhaps, I guess, that you can do it because it's funny. You know, kids like farts and belt burping jokes and stuff like that. But, you know, aside from a kid's party, I just, you know, some things I just don't think that are right for adults. And I see this, you know, sometimes that people are still doing this after all these years. Just my opinion. I'm sorry I got off on a tangent. This is about you, not me. But
well, you know, I have different presentations of the same trick for different kinds of groups sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that one presentation fits all situations might be just a false idea that magicians have. And
you know,
that if you're doing something for a business group, that's one kind of thing. If you're doing it for a church group, that's another thing. If you're doing it for a lesbian party, that might be another thing.
Entirely right. You know, the Invisible Deck, perfect example. That I've got a presentation, you know, that you would do and walk around and close up a strolling, in which I use a miniature deck and everything. And it's baffling. It's a great trick, no question, a good opener. But I do it in the context of a seance, completely different, in which I'll use a Glorpy and then a little skeleton hand, and I have a little doily that's around the wrist, and so it looks like, you know, it's kind of spooky, and I have a little box, and I put it on top of there, and the glorping moves, and, you know, as if you're playing cards with the child, you know, what card did you think of, you know, will the child, you know, reverse that card, and suddenly, instead of a, wow, that's cool, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, it changes the atmosphere. It's like bizarre magic versus bubblegum for the eyes, funny magic, you know, so presentation makes all the difference.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what Larry says, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, Larry, you can jump in here.
Well, one thing I would say is, as magicians, we're always creating effects on our audiences. Always. Always. The only question is if the magician has been thoughtful about the effects they're trying and intending to create.
Is that the effect you wanted?
Exactly.
I see what you're saying.
And so that can't be bought at the magic shop. That has to be decided in the mind of the magician or in the community of magicians that the person is in. What kinds of effects do I want this to make upon an audience? So if I just bring out the bra trick, that's going to have effects on people in my audience. And I better have thought about that in advance and be willing to pay the price if I haven't thought it through. So, you know, this is actually very practical. It's not theoretical at all to say to a master class student, what effect are you trying to create with that particular routine?
Yeah.
Because there's no escaping those effects.
So what kind of advice do you normally give people is there some common mistake that people make in their performances when you are trying to judge them? What would that be?
Well, I think not having a script, working off of a general outline only. And once that's done,
winging it, huh? Improvising.
Well, you have a general idea.
Where you want to go, start and finish.
But you don't have a script, and so now we find the insertion of phrases like, what I want you to do now
is, man, I hate that.
Do me a favor, and what I'm going to do now is... And this just shows a kind of lack of preparation.
Same thing of an opening. I hate the phrase, how are you doing tonight?
Right, right.
That's a lazy way out.
As Jeff says, you know, I mean, what are you asking for? Their health record?
Exactly.
One of the things I would add into this is many magicians come to us not having sufficient theatrical direction. And this is one of the things that happens in the master class in terms of just practical theatrical experiences. We help, we give students theatrical direction so that their shows are more polished theatrically. How are you going to enter? What kind of eye contact are you making? How are you standing? What position are your feet in? How much do you flap your hands around?
Right.
These are very important things that will either...
You need to command the stage.
Exactly. Kind of it'll either contribute to your show in a positive way or they'll detract from your show in a negative
way. Not everyone has a director, and I think that everybody is lacking. I say everybody, every magician or performer in general. You know, I don't care if you play guitar on stage or whatever that you do, you know, that you still need to have some direction of some sort. You know, I was fortunate at the Magic Island in Houston, you know, that I had Scott Hollingsworth who gave me good direction and told me how to take command of the stage, you know, rock back and forth, and also to use the stage also. I mean, it doesn't just mean to stand in one on that X. You have to kind of make use of all the stage. And I think it's important that you have someone who can stand back and look objectively, you know, at your show rather than, you know, your wife saying, oh, I think that's good, honey, you know, or your friends, you know, just patting you back. You need, you know, sometimes people, I think, to give you some harsh criticism.
No one can ever self-direct. It's not possible. We all have blind spots. Yeah. Every single one.
You close up or stage?
Eugene has smaller ones. But
they're not always that small. No, because I take a lot of direction from you, from Jeff, from Max Maven. You know, people, good friends who have just always helped me.
And giving you honest feedback.
Right. And I remember in 1999 when I did the show at the Shakespeare Festival, the director, Tom O'Horgan, just left me alone. It was ghost scenes from Shakespeare with magic tricks in between. And, you know, Max Maven came to probably three-quarters of the rehearsals, would sit in the back and take notes for me. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go out for coffee afterward, and he'd kind of give me all these notes. Whereas the director just kind of backed off on the magician and let the magician do what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
But the magician, me, didn't want to just do anything. I wanted to do what was going to work.
Yeah.
And I was needing direction. I had never done anything on a stage. That was my first stage appearance.
Yeah.
And Max just saved the day for me.
Right.
This is what happens at a master class, is that our students come and they get many, many things, but they do get professional direction. And there are not that many places in magic today to go and get professional direction. People who have been trained.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Like Bob Fitch and a few others. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's invaluable. I know someone who says, magicians are the only theatrical artists overall that don't realize they need direction. And I'm not sure that that's true universally. Many people do.
It has to do with ego. I think magicians are egotistical, myself included, to begin with. And you have to be egotistical to a degree to think that people are going to love what you do.
Yes. Part of it, too, is that as magicians, we have to do it all. We have to write our scripts. We have to work on our technique. We have to build our props. And so we naturally think that we can direct ourselves, too.
But you need to recognize there are other people who are specializing in those kinds of things. I learned that, actually, from Mark Kalin, because he was saying, I can do it all, but I don't have time to do it all because I can't then get around to everything. So he said, I'll have somebody, I'll go to an ad agency to have them create this, or somebody do a video rather than me trying to put it all together, or, you know, somebody choreographing or building the illusion instead of me. I mean, yeah, you can do it, but, you know, it's guns or butter. You know, it's simple economics. You can do one or the other, you know.
One thing we were talking to the youth seminar, the Lance Burton Youth Seminar about was... save the money from one trick you were going to buy, you know, and put that toward having someone help you write a script so that you have good words rather than empty blather. And, you know, we don't need a closet full of tricks we're never going to perform. If we'd saved the money on half of those tricks and we actually invested in good words, we'd be better off. So what it is, I think, sometimes magicians don't realize that they need to pay for some of this extra assistance.
But if they didn't ask that, let me ask you then, where would one go to find a competent scriptwriter for magicians?
I would say that probably everybody knows someone in their family or extended group who has a talent for good words.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean they'll necessarily be a good scriptwriter for magic, but you could work with someone in your circle.
So they shouldn't necessarily be a magician.
Not necessarily, though they could be.
Yeah. But you got a funny uncle or somebody, for an example, or whatever.
Someone who's really good with words, someone who's good writing, someone who loves to write. They can work with someone to help take a script and make it better.
Yeah.
But the other thing, too, is there is real specialization in script writing. Eugene specializes in this. I do this. And these are things we advise students on all the time.
I write scripts for a lot of magicians.
Jim
Steinmeier wrote Alex Ramone's show.
Did he?
Oh, yeah.
That's well done, you know.
And beautifully done.
I thought he was...
Larry writes scripts for people. So there are people around in magic who actually do this.
Right.
But
some people, some younger people in particular, I think would... Those just getting started or listening to this podcast might be thinking, yeah, but, you know, how do I approach Jim Steinmeier? I mean, he's Jim Steinmeier and I'm just Joe Blow, you know. I mean, I think you just need to have some... fortitude and go and approach somebody, ask them. I mean, that's their job anyhow. I mean, you go to a plumber if you want to get, you know, your drain fixed. I mean, you're not going to go and try and do it yourself. You go to a professional, and, you know, you shouldn't feel anxious just because they have a celebrated name.
And all life is this tension between fear and courage.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to conquer our fears. Yes. And we do that through courage. And courage means just acting in spite of. Three magic words, in spite of our fears.
Mm-hmm.
You might find that Jim Steinmeier is the most approachable person in the world.
When you talk with him, it's right. It's like, well, why? You know, why didn't I talk to him
before? Larry and I are pretty approachable.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I think that's what people need to know, is that they shouldn't feel badly about coming up. I mean, people coming up are like, well, I go and ask me for autographs and things like that. I think that's part of the cool thing, I think, about conventions, you know, that you get that close association that you don't get through YouTube or through forums or whatever else. You know, you have this personal interaction that you can actually talk to people and find out, for an example, you know, that, hey, Eugene, I've been working on something. Could you help me? I'll pay you for, you know, an idea for a script. I've just, you know, a few lines, you know, here and there. Don't steal ideas from other people. You know, they are their babies, you know, that they worked on, and they spent years developing, and you just don't take things from people, you know. And that's another thing I think people get put into an awkward situation whenever they will come to you or me or whomever and say, oh, I like that trick. I like that line. Can I use that? Well, you know, I've kind of had that for a long time. That's my thing, you know. You know, what do you say to somebody like that?
Well, you have to be prepared for someone to say no.
Yeah.
I mean, or say, I'm too busy to help you.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But if you don't ask, you're never going to get what you want.
I've always said, you know, might as well ask out the prom queen for a date. What's she going to say but no?
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
What's the
exactly.
worst? You're not going to die.
Exactly. See, I think, you know, in a sense, we already have proto-scripts.
Okay.
You know, in other words, if you just took your favorite trick that you performed the most and audio-recorded it and typed it out, exactly
yeah.
what you said,
yeah.
us and does included,
yeah. you know,
now you've got something to begin editing. So it's not like this is beyond everybody. I mean, we already have something you're saying, and the aim is, as Larry's wonderful phrase, to take bad words and turn them into good words.
Yeah.
Good words. That's what the meaning of a script is.
Hmm.
And that's a very important thing, and Larry stresses that a lot.
Yeah. Well, there are all kinds of voice-to-text programs now that you can get online or apps or whatever, so why not? I mean, after you have recorded, you know, I remember Gene Anderson always saying, you know, he would always record all the shows. Of course, now you can easily set up, you know, your iPhone. You can record it video. If you want audio, that's fine, too. But then you can then later, you know, record, put that onto to text, and then once you have it on the screen, you look at that and say, wow, did I say that many times?
And how many? I mean, I was at my invention some years ago, and a very famous mentalist, in the first 45 minutes of his hour talk, said, do me a favor, and 29 times.
I was there.
And I
stopped
remember
counting, writing it down, yes.
And I stopped counting. And
I think
that show would have been better with maybe only 11 of those. Okay,
yeah.
7.
Yeah.
No, 4. No, better, maybe none.
Yeah, better, yeah.
I think the conversation about scripting has gotten too attached to the word script,
mm-hmm.
which is a technical theater term, and it is absolutely correct. But
see, I'm one of the people that brought that word in.
You did. Eugene introduced the word script.
Because it used to be pattern, which I thought was so awful.
And it is awful.
There's a huge difference. Pattern's bad, script is good.
But I found the word script scares too many people.
Mm.
And really what it's all about, as Eugene said, is good words. That's it. The whole thing. Are your words good, or are they not very good, or are they bad? And I don't care where they come from. I don't care who writes them or where you get them. I mean, as long as you're not stealing other people's material.
Mm-hmm.
But the really hard question magicians need to ask themselves, am I using good words when I perform magic, or am I using empty blather? And we can take some of the fear and some of the stress out just by changing the word from script to good words. We want good words.
What is the title?
And good words are words that achieve the goals the individual performer wants. And bad words are words that do not help achieve the goal that this individual performer
doesn't
wants.
Doesn't carry the act forward.
And different performers have different goals.
Sure.
Some people might want the audience laughing. I might want them terrified.
Some in tears. Yeah.
Right.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
And so as Larry said earlier, the first thing is, what is your goal?
Mm-hmm.
And the secondly, are the words you're using advancing to that goal, or are they moving you away from it? And that's a pretty empirical, basic question that's not theoretical at all.
No,
it's
right.
Eminently practical.
I'm trying to think, who was the author of the book? It was one on script writing.
Pete McCabe.
What was it called?
Scripting Magic.
It's called Scripting Magic, yep, which is another good book, I think. And if you haven't got that, I'd recommend them as well. There are a few things out there like that people can start with, at least, if they don't have a mentor or somebody nearby. Of course, you've got an internet. You can just write to Eugene at magicbeer.com.
The good news, too, is that there are many quality magic books that have full scripts in them. And this is becoming more common practice. So all of Eugene's books have his scripts, and all of my books have my scripts, and Jeff McBride's book has his scripts, and Bob Neal's. So it used to be you had to create scripts out of nothingness, but in the last 20 or so years, creators are actually publishing their scripts while they publish their tricks. So there's no good reason not to start with good words.
The first time I saw that was in Tom Mollica's book, in which it was live from the tomfoolery, and not only had the script, but the time stamps, so you knew his pacing and how, what kind of time. And if you're going to be doing that, you know, then it's good to, I mean, I speak fast, I know, and I'm on stage, and I'm always trying to slow myself down, and people tell me that all the time, and I recognize that. I've gone to Toastmasters. It's just, it's my style. It's hard to do. But, you know, a good idea, the Fielding West gave us a tip a while back, and that is to use a metronome. So this way that, you know, they're just going back and forth, and you're actually trying to keep up with the metronome going back and forth. And then when you're performing, you know, you can, tap your hand, you know, on your leg or something in a certain beat. And so that way that between laughs or applause that you would, you know, tap one, two, three, and you'll step on your own lines or your own laugh, you know, at certain times. I thought that was a good tip.
Very good advice.
Yeah. Well, we kind of spun off in a little... That was kind of the direction I was wanting to go, though. It was just something a little bit more esoteric, so appreciate it.
I like esoteric.
Yes.
Well, esoteric is good.
Yeah. And for me, as so many of the things we've talked about, again, they're so practical because they have to do with how successful you will be as a performer on any given night. So they sound theoretical. They're actually
practical.
Ultimately the root work of being a performer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you guys very much. I know we got another close-up contest to go to over here, so the finals of that. Thank you very much, Eugene and Larry, that I've asked you both before, I think, about what your magic word is, because it is called the Magic Word Podcast. I remember that you had said abracadabra was a word that you used. But let's go beyond that. You know, what is actually your philosophy of life? What is your slogan? What is important to you? What's your achieve?
In 24 words or less?
Yes, it could be.
No, let me think. Let me start counting. I think it really, I think life is this tension between fear and courage. And that at every moment, at every age, we have to conquer fear with courage.
Mm-hmm.
And
fight
we
or flight
do that in spite of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have faith in spite of doubt. I have courage in spite of fear.
Yeah. Excellent. Larry?
Well, as a philosophy professor, there are many things I would say, but I will share something very personal to me, which is that I am always aspiring to be more excellent. Mm. The end result will take care of itself if along the way and every day I do my best to do better and more excellent work in the process. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the thing I try. Every day I ask myself, what's the thing I need today to make this book or this routine better and more excellent? And I think keeping your eye on excellence makes it more likely that I'll hit it in the process.
That's kind of a goal for life, I guess. You know, you have to have a plan. You have to plan your work and work your plan. That's what I always say. You know, and so if you try to achieve excellence on a daily basis, that's a goal. But unless you have a tangible thing saying, I am going to achieve excellence today by X, you know, by achieving a certain thing, you know, then it's more achievable. You could finish that before lunch.
Exactly.
You know, it's like,
right.
As opposed to waiting until the end of the evening, I haven't done anything yet because I didn't know what I was going to do.
Yes.
You know, so make them tangible.
One last thought on this is so much in our culture is distracts us and interferes with our pursuing the path of excellence. It's easy to turn on the TV or computer, as Eugene says. And part of the big thing in being excellent on a day-to-day basis is identifying the distractions and avoiding them.
And to wind this up with a quote from the Tao Te Ching, where it is written, if I have even just a little sense, I will keep to the main road. And my only fear will be of straying from it. Keeping to the main road is easy, but people love to be sidetracked.
Wow. Eugene Berger. Dr. Larry Howe. Haas.
Oh, you've been a cleaner.
That's right. I think he did a grand slam. Scotty out. For the magic word, Scotty out. For the magicwordpodcast.com, and the dealers are all wrapping up and packing their boxes and getting ready to head out. And I guess they can keep things for a little while longer before the next convention, which is, I'm sure, just right around the corner. I know that Abbott's is coming up, probably the next one. And we have a lot of conventions. Of course, the TAOM, and next year is going to be just a jumble of conventions. And I've got the master of one of them who's going to be here with me right now, Stan Allen. Hello, Stan.
Good morning.
It seems like morning, doesn't it?
It is.
What is it? It's 4:30 p.m. Just for people who are listening, but when you don't sleep, you know, this is one of those conventions in which that that old adage of it's only a three-day convention doesn't work as far as, you know, not getting any sleep, and this has been 6 days. Or as I like to say, I said at the very beginning, that Stan Allen said this was a six-day or three-day convention packed into 6 days.
I think that was Mike Close.
Yeah. Oh, was Mike said that?
I think I said something about by Thursday I'll be looking for a movie and by Saturday a razor blade. This is a long convention. It's been fun. I mean, you get to see a lot of people, but it's still a very long convention.
It has been, and then full of competitions, a lot of contests throughout the thing. I really didn't get a chance to go and see and hear any of the lectures, but I did attend all of the contests. Strong competition all around.
It was a good contest last night. The seven finalists to the stage. I was actually, I'll say, lucky enough to be one of the judges, and I hadn't been in that process for a while, and, mm-hmm. and it was great to sit around and with the acts afterwards, and you know, it's supposed to be a critique, but it turned into a lot of brainstorming, which was just fun. It's good people. There were some very good people.
Yeah, the IBM does it differently from the SAM, you know, because you were judging for the SAM.
I was judging for the SAM.
And I was judging for the IBM, and then afterwards we sat around and we didn't talk, and you know, we can give them our critiques on paper, but we don't go back and sit with them, whereas the SAM, you actually go back and, like you say, you kind of brainstorm with them and say what worked and didn't work and why.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
It went till late or early in the morning.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So that's why it seems like morning for you when you say good morning over here. Well, speaking of conventions, next year is going to be Magic Live.
Good segue.
I thought that you were, what's up with the 360? Tell me about, isn't there going to be like a 360 convention?
There was going to be. We were working on, you have to go back about a year and a half, almost 2 years, and we were looking down the schedule and we thought, well, there's a combined IBM, there's a FISM, and then there's a blank year. So what if we just skipped? You know, usually when we're in the summer, we're the big dog for that year. Mm-hmm. At least it has been for the time being. It won't be forever, but at the time being. And we're not competing against a combined or a FISM very often. And so we put together a streaming-type convention for those off years, smaller conventions. And a funny thing happened. We themed the last Magic Live Friends, and it really took off.
Yeah, it really did.
People loved it, and they came to me afterwards talking all about, oh, I saw so many friends. Oh, I made so many friends. Friends this, right. Friends that. It's not like we branded the whole convention Friends. It just
happened
to take off. Yeah. And so some of these things, you know, you plan out, and they don't work the way you think they're going to work, and others, they work better than you ever thought they were going to work, and you still get credit for it. It's a beautiful world.
Or blame for it.
Plenty of blame. Yeah. There's no question, too. Within a few days after Live, I was starting to think about, do we really want to stream something? Do we really want to go digital? And over the next 3 or 4 months, we kept drawing up M360, it was called. And I just wasn't happy with the way I was drawing it up. And it's not that it wasn't coming together well. It was. I think it was me. And I had changed. And I decided that we don't need more streaming and more internet. Penguin's doing a weekly lecture. Murphy's is doing a weekly lecture. I know the SAM has some kind of a monthly thing. I don't know what the IBM has, but you know, there's a lot of information coming down that pipeline. So I decided, we were going to do a turnaround. We're going to do a 180, and we're going to go back to old school.
It's going to go half the way, not all the way 360.
Not
just 180.
All the way 360, just a 180. And we're going to go old school, and we're going to throw another Magic Live, and we're going to bring people together again, and we're not going to stream a convention.
Okay.
So that left M360 sitting over to the side, the designs for it, the conversations on Magic. So what we did was we moved M360 into one of our digital platforms. And so the concept that was being built as a streaming download became a subscriber-only place on MagicMagazine.com for our subscribers. It's conversations on Magic. It's subject-driven. We have interviews on there with like people like Matt King and Kevin James and Chipper Lowell and Fielding West about hecklers.
Okay.
So there's 12 minutes on hecklers, or 15 minutes about picking the volunteer out of the audience. So that's what M360 is about, plus exclusive video. We did 3.5 hours. I didn't know this. We did an interview with Doug Henning. David Charvet conducted it in 1999. And we printed that in October, and Doug was gone in February.
Right.
So I mentioned to David that we were doing this new digital thing, and he said to me, well, now, Stan, you did know that I videoed that Henning thing. No, I didn't. I guess I did at the time, but we had no use for video at the time. Well, we have a 26-minute slug of Doug Henning talking about the Magic Show, and we'll use more of that over the years. So we have all this exclusive content, Magic Live content. So that's what M360 is.
So that was a little bit different than what the Essential Magic Conference, EMC, was.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was involved in the EMC. I was a speaker for 3 years. Right. Magic Magazine was a sponsor from day one, partially because I was looking down the road and saying, hey, we're gonna need to go online with these conventions. They're not going to be able to stay this size. But knock on wood, Magic Live is staying it. We opened up our registration a couple weeks ago, and we're closing in on 1,000 people. That's two-thirds of our size.
Wow, that's right. Now, I recall in the past that you have capped it and then opened another theater or made the changes. And then
we did that one year. One year we bounced people back and so forth so much, we didn't even know where we were coming from, because I'd gone back to a theater that I thought had 800 seats plus another 150 seats.
Expandable, yeah.
Yeah, and then when I called them up and said, how many extra seats do you have? They said, yeah, Fire Marshal won't let us use those anymore.
Oh, wonderful.
And we were selling those seats already.
Yeah.
And we're going, all right, stop everything.
Yeah.
You know? So it was kind of crazy. We had to start and stop. But now we don't. We know where we're at now. We did just over 1,500 people.
In the same theater. I mean, same hotel.
Yeah, we did the Orleans. We're going to go back to the Orleans. It's not open yet as far as our registration for a hotel is available. Yet the contract's still on my desk. But it'll be open by probably the end of July.
Okay.
And we have two 800-seat showrooms, basically. Mm-hmm. So we can do 1,600 if we want to. And that's a big enough convention. That's plenty big.
It is large enough, and still being able to see friends, as you were saying the last time. You know, it's going to be kind of hard to top when you've got a nice theme that's easy to recognize, understand, and remember. You know, when it's a one-word type of a thing, and people get it.
We have three of those themes right now.
Okay.
Just not sure which one we're going to use.
Don't want to share any of those yet.
Not going to share a single thing.
Right.
Are you kidding? I shared M360, and here
already.
I am backing up from it. So what's wrong with me? You know. So no, I'm having a ball. I was telling somebody the other day, if you think it's fun to go to one of these conventions like Magic Live, you should be in on the planning of it, because we just have a lot of fun.
Sure.
We dream up stuff. It's an advantage. We have a team that will dream up something, and it's not why we can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody to tell us why we can't do it. Mm-hmm. And so it's just more fun.
That is great. Let me ask you, going in a different direction, if I can, about just magazines and print, and you're saying that you're not going to be doing so much digital because it seems that Murphy's and Penguin are kind of taking that niche, I guess, and so we're still doing things with Magic, with the Magic Plus and the
no, we're not.
And everything.
We're actually now, we've gone full digital. I was trying to do an iPad digital that was, you know, as good as any digital magazine I've found out there. But Adobe makes it difficult for the small publisher to do that. And so we've just made a conscious decision to go in a different direction. We have a PDF version of our magazine, and it's the same kind of thing that Genie has and that MUM has and that Linking Ring has.
Yeah.
And to me, those templates are not the easiest thing to read.
Right.
But they do the job. You can get there and you can
see it. Searchable.
And what sets us apart from the others is that we don't have a big backlog. We're not offering those. But we have something that we think is the future. And that's where I moved M360 to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where all those special digital videos. And we're even putting some of our columns and some of our stories there, but they're not PDFs. Anything that goes to M360 is all about the ease of reading, is all about quality, not quantity.
Okay.
And everything that's there has been redesigned for there. Like right now, we have the 1964 World's Fair Show Hall of Magic playing for the month of July. The entire 14-minute show, Mark Wilson doing it.
Right.
And Mark Wilson people have been nice enough to loan us that thing for that one month.
So it's only going to be playing for the 1 month?
It is. Certain things will only be up and down. And we're still building. We're still... Somebody said, well, it's like a playground for everybody. And we say, yeah, it is. You get to pick whatever you want to do. For us, it's a laboratory.
Okay.
That I don't know where the digital world is going. And I don't think anybody knows where it's going.
No.
And so what we've done
is... it's moving quickly.
We're creating a place for us to experiment and to try and to reshape. And you can look at M360 now, and probably in a year from now you'll look at M360, and it may not look anything like that.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we hope to design the next iteration of magazines and digital magazines. Mm-hmm. So our digital presence has actually gotten bigger, and that's why we were here to promote M360.
Right. Right. Yeah, it sounds kind of like QVC. You know, you better buy it now because once they're gone, they're gone. So, you know, see this month.
Well, it's not a lot of that stuff. And my team kind of beats me up because they're of the school. Everything should be on the Internet forever and you should have it forever.
Yeah.
And I'm more of a, can we create an urgency? And can we get people to go to this at one time and then talk about it and share it? And that's part of what M360 is becoming. It isn't there yet.
And you're going to have a forum and everything then? Or?
It won't be a forum.
Okay, so you won't be able to talk about it.
It's going to be much more categorized. It's going to be slightly moderated. It's not going to be a free-for-all session. Your name, your city, and your state will appear because we have that as a subscriber.
That's right. Good.
There will
so you can't hide behind some
anonymity. You cannot
anonymity.
Hide behind anything, and we will delete things that are not appropriate. When I say appropriate, I remember I was at EMC, and a speaker's up there pouring out 15 years of experience how to do something.
Yeah.
And I went online to see what the chat room was doing.
Right.
Boy, what an ugly tie. And for 15, next 15, you know, posts or something, it's all about the guy's tie. And you say, you know what, I'm sorry. I'm not going to give bandwidth to this.
Yeah.
So if you like that, you know what, we've got two good forums.
Yeah.
You know, I can't seem to ever find what I'm looking for there, but we have two, long-running forums, Genie Forum,
Magic Cafe.
Yeah. And I think there's plenty of places for people to talk there. That's not what I'm
looking
for here.
Yeah.
I'm really looking to say, hey, we're talking about hecklers here. And here's Chipper Lowell's great, how he deals with a heckler. It's hysterical. You got to go watch it.
Okay.
And then afterwards, I want people to say, well, you know, I used to do this with a heckler. And somebody else says, yeah, I tried that, but it backfired here.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have a conversation going.
Yeah.
And to do that, I think you need moderators, and you need to, I won't say retrain, but to change the mental state of what online conversation can be.
Yeah.
So, again, the best thing, be together at a convention, or possibly be together at your club meeting, and then, you know, second to that, hey, online, the world is available. But let's have an intelligent conversation.
I think that's right. Rather than just being someone who's going to be, I start saying assassin, but just a someone who is a stealth sleuth, you know, just throwing out barbs or, you know, trying to shoot somebody and then leaving. It's just
not what we're after. I used to get letters from people when somebody would write a bad review, bad product review.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter would have nothing to do with the product review other than to say, yeah, I saw this reviewer perform once. He was lousy.
Yeah.
I said, what does that have to do with the review?
Right.
And so, you know, we would like to keep some focus.
Sure.
I think the Internet and the world, we don't live in the world. We don't live in the age of information. We live in the age of distraction. There's more distraction.
You're the second person
right
I've heard say that today.
Really?
Yeah.
They're stealing material from me. No, we are. And the amazing part is we've taken all the distractions in the world and packaged them in what was used to be a phone. It's all right there.
It can
interrupt you at any time of day or night.
Well, and that's true. And that's something in which that it seems kind of funny whenever that you're in a conversation or whatever and the phone rings, you know, and you pick it up and that, you know, suddenly it's like this is more important than the conversation we were just having.
Absolutely. I remember first Magic Live. Lance Burton is interviewing Channing Pollock.
Yeah.
And you hear a phone ring. And then you hear somebody say, hello, I'm walking outside. Hang on, please. And they walk out. So I came on afterwards. I was hosting that day. And I came on afterwards. I said, is it just me? I want to know who was on that phone call that was that important to walk out of this moment that you'll never get again.
Yeah.
You know. And so it is true, though. people today, man, as soon as that text goes off or whatever.
I was working at the in the close-up room of Magic Castle a few weeks ago, and there was some lady, like in the second row, that was texting throughout the whole show. She never looked up at once. And then she only got up because it was an empty seat, and she sat there. And then she finally, before my last effect, stood up by the table and just looking at me, you know. And I said, hey, you know, are you in a hurry, you know? And she said, well, I got to go. And I said, well, I got this show, and as soon as I'm finished, we can all go, you know. Yeah, but it was, how rude can it be?
You know? I heard something about a new game the kids are playing or something where you sit down at the table for dinner.
Yeah.
And everybody puts their cell phones out.
Yeah.
In the middle of the table.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person who picks up the phone, yours can ring,
you
have
to or
can vibrate, but whoever picks up the phone first buys dinner.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I think it's a great idea.
I was just talking with Joey Crisill a couple days ago, and he was saying that John Stetson had, you know, come on stage and was, you know, he pointed out someone immediately, you know, in the audience and said, I want to recognize so-and-so who just received a word that going to be getting a new liver transplant. You know, and I think that is great. You know, she's going to have a whole new life, and it's going to change her life. You know, everybody's giving her a big applause and everything. You know, and then they say, "Well, I'm not sure if that's what it is, but since she's back there texting, it must be so important that this is what it must have been." You know.
And speaking of that, I'm involved in something else, and it's sort of in the same line. It's called the Magic Summit.
Yes.
And it's in November, around the 14th, 15th of November, and it's
and the SAM is involved.
The SAM and Magic Magazines are sponsors.
Okay.
And so they're the ones kind of supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
The production team is myself and Brian Daniel and Vinnie Grasso. And so we're an independent team throwing this on our own. So it's not...
And the idea is
first of all, it's open to everybody. It's not an SAM activity, even though they've supplied us with seed money from the endowment fund, and they've been very generous about that. The idea is that we're back to that face-to-face, old-school interaction. And you say, well, fine, where do you get it? You go to a convention, you're overloaded with it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's great, and you go away. But where do you get it on a regular basis? Used to be a magic shop.
Yeah.
I used to go to Hollywood Magic all the time. Yeah. People talk about growing up in New York, going to Tannen's every Saturday morning.
Right.
You saw everybody. You went to lunch with your friends.
Right.
So you bonded right there. And where do they do that now? Well, the only place that's really available to do that is your magic club. And yet, most magic clubs are somewhat struggling. That's what we hear.
Correct.
And, you know, they don't have interesting activities. Their membership, they're having trouble with retention. They're not getting new members. And so we've taken the creative team, plus the Magic Live creative team,
mm-hmm.
and input. We're going to be surveying a lot of people and get input from a lot of things to find out, what does your magic club do well?
Mm-hmm.
What does your magic club not do so well?
And right.
The slogan is, well, come learn and come share. So this is not going to be a magic convention that is a one-way street. In fact, it's not going to be a convention at all.
Right.
It's not a one-way street. It's a two-way conversation all about how can we make these clubs stronger. Because my belief is if we make all of these clubs stronger, be them assemblies, be them rings, be them independent, then the organizations are going to do better, and magic overall is going to do better. My business, Magic Magazine, is going to do better.
Yeah, it'll help everybody.
Tide raises all the boats.
I was just going to say that, right?
Yeah, and so that's what this conference is. It's for people that want to improve the club experience at their local.
And this will be where and when?
It's going to be in Las Vegas, November 14th, the night of it starts, and it's all day the 15th and a little bit the morning of the 16th.
Okay.
It'll be at Sam's Town. So we're a little away from the
way from the strip over there. But
it's not, again, it's not your typical come here and go see shows and everything.
Right.
No, we want you there.
And share.
We want you sharing.
There and share. And
sharing and learning. And I think that there's good answers to these things. I just don't think we've thought about it enough.
Well, every club has a little bit of a twist of what they do in order to try to get members. And I think a lot of that all boils down to communication, you know, of whether that you use a website, whether that you use telephone, you know, getting everybody out, but then also to have quality meetings and something so people can come to learn something and feel as if that I'm getting something out of, if I'm spending this kind of time away from my family, I want to have benefit.
Well, I agree, and I think that I don't know. I had a thought there.
There was.
It was absolutely gone. What were you talking about?
Yeah.
No, but I think that it's a It's a question of relations. I grew up in a magic club in Southern California, Long Beach Mystics. And why did we grow the way we did? Why did we develop the way we did?
Because you're helping each other.
A lot of it has to do that we were friends.
Yeah.
We didn't just get together once a month on the third Thursday.
You had lunch and you'd work together.
You would help each other. Yeah. You'd call each other. You'd show each other what you're doing. You hung out. You went to the movies together. Mm-hmm. You did lots of stuff. So these, you had a friend. You joined the club and you were suddenly a part of something. Mm-hmm. And I think that's critically important in magic clubs. I think people have to have friends there, which means when a new club member shows up, you've got to welcome them in and make them a friend. And you're talking about communication? Sure. Well, that's what friends would do. They would call up and say, hey, you're going to the meeting Saturday night?
I get that.
My wife's got the car. You need a ride? We'll come and get you.
Yeah.
This is what friends do. And the club meeting should also be a place. It's a place where you should have fun. And you should develop your friendships. Mm-hmm. And you should learn. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just that simple.
That simple, yeah.
And just that complicated.
Yeah.
This is
what they're going to be talking about then, mainly of sharing
this
and giving
exactly
ideas, what we do and what's successful, what hasn't worked, and all
and
that.
We don't, I'm not saying we're going to have all the answers.
Well, it's a
we're
moving
going to develop
thing.
Some of the things. It's a moving,
it's
target.
Target.
It's no question a moving target. Mm-hmm. But I do think that if we get back to magic is not on the internet, mm-hmm. One of the sections at the conference planned is using the internet to get off the internet. So it's a tool, and we need to use it for that, and then get people sharing. Magic's supposed to be shown to other people.
That's
and
right.
Nobody appreciates magic like magicians appreciate each other's work. So let's get together, and let's use that club and get that club moving and active. And yeah, it's going to be an interesting... I got into it because I said, gosh, I don't know how you fix this. That makes it fun to think about.
Yeah. Well, I've always said that a magician who's not working is only fooling himself.
There you go.
And that's true. You're just kind of home, you know, doing nothing. You have to be sharing, you know. I remember Robert Lund had said that I'm just a curator of magic. He said magicians are those who perform.
There's no question in the hierarchy of the magicians that are out there performing, the professional magicians. But there's also a social aspect of magic.
No question.
And it doesn't mean you have to be the greatest magician. It doesn't mean you have to learn the greatest new moves and the greatest new tricks. But what I find, I've got a lot of readers. We've got a lot of people that come to Magic Live. And most of them don't earn a dime performing a magic trick.
Yeah.
But they love magic, and they want to learn more about it.
Yeah.
They constantly want to learn and learn the newest, latest trick. Sure, it's a hobby.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Good. Great. Love it.
They apparently think a lot of it, too.
They love my comments over there, don't they? I'm getting an ovation here,
that's
folks.
That's right. Pipe in over there in the other thing. All right. Well, listen, Stan, thank you very much. Have you got everything all packed? You're about ready to head
I'm out, all packed you? Out, but I'll just say this. Yes. Magic Live 2015.
The dates are?
August 9th through the 12th.
And you can sign up, and the URL is?
It's there already, magicmagazine.com. And,
where you can access the 360.
You can if you're a subscriber.
Subscriber.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so come to Vegas in the most beautiful time of the year. Yeah, maybe that part's not so true.
Well, it's a dry heat. Yeah.
Yeah, so is my oven, and I don't stick my head in it.
Thank you, Mike Finney. Okay.
It was Carson.
Thank you. Was it? Okay, we'll take it.
Right.
And what is your magic word? I think I've asked you about this before. What's important to you? What is your philosophy of life? What's your slogan?
Oh, a simple question like that. Yeah. I'm sorry, what are you saying?
Well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So what is your magic word?
Oh, really? You have a podcast?
Here, shall I give you one of these little cards over here to remind you?
Well, let's see. What is my magic word?
Yeah. It didn't have to be a word. It could be a phrase. It could be something that's important.
I still think one of the most important things in magic is relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to understand relationships. And it's important to realize that, you know, one of the things I hate is the expression, it never hurts to ask. Mm-hmm. It does hurt to ask. It changes a relationship, and a relationship is everything.
Mm-hmm.
You want a mentor, you go to the person, and you ask for help on a question. Not the answer. Where could I find this?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, you ought to read this book. You know what you do then? You go back and you read the book,
right. And
when you come back to them, and you explain, I read the book, I didn't understand this part, but I got this part. You've started building a relationship. And that's what will happen, and we hope that happens in clubs, and we hope that happens through M360 and everywhere else. But I think that's it. We're a communal body. Magic's a communal body. more so than any other variety arts. I mean, we published a magazine for jugglers for 8 years, and mm-hmm. it's not the same. Mm-hmm. And puppeteers is not the same. And I think it's partially because it takes magicians to understand sometimes what the other magician is doing and how difficult that skill is. That, you know,
yeah.
that guy's not using an invisible deck to accomplish that trick. Uh-huh. You know, he's actually yeah. doing the work. So we want to be part of this community anyway.
Right.
Now I think we just need, for the people organizing clubs, organizing conventions and things, we just have to understand that relationship.
And that's what it's all about, is relationships. That's great.
That's it.
I appreciate our relationship a lot.
I can't talk anymore.
That's it.
Our relationship's over.
And so this podcast will end as well, for at least this interview.
You're not
going to
say
chat.
Scotty out, are you?
So, for the Magic Word Podcast.
Can I tell you that's really hokey, or really corny?
That's going on my tombstone.
Stan
Pizza.
Out.
What can I add?
For more content, including pictures of those I spoke with in this podcast, commentary, links, timestamps, show notes, and more, be sure to visit the webpage at themagicwordpodcast.com. And you can help spread the word by liking the Magic Word Podcast on Facebook and sharing with your friends. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Till next time, Scotty out.